It's almost taken for granted that technology is changing America. Whether we're talking about job losses, election meddling, or the role of big data in healthcare, technology is everywhere. Today's guest, through her remarkable fiction, warns that technology is changing our personal relationships and our families too. She's Helen Schulman this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to study, celebrate, and tell stories that matter. We do that by visiting each week with the best contemporary storytellers around. Authors, scholars, filmmakers, and more. Really anyone using or studying narrative to explain the world around us. This week, we're joined by Helen Schulman, a novelist, short story writer, screenwriter, and nonfiction author. She's the chair of fiction for the MFA Creative Writing Program at the New School in Manhattan. And this spring, she was named a 2019 Guggenheim Fellow for her fiction writing. Helen, welcome and congratulations on all of your success.
Oh, thank you so much.
So you've got a wonderful body of work that we want to talk about, but we want to begin with your most recent novel, Come With Me, which explores sort of this relationship between technology and individual human beings and family structures and all of that. Tell us about the book.
Well, the book takes place in Silicon Valley. There's a mother and a father, Amy and Dan. Amy works for her college roommate's son, who's a junior at Stanford, in a startup. And it takes place over three non-consecutive days where the family is really rocked by several events that happen. And it's got eight different points of view, and it takes place in Silicon Valley and in Dallas and in Fukushima, Japan in the present, in New York and San Francisco in the past. So it was kind of complicated to write.
You're exploring this idea of multiverses, right? And this sort of that are accessible through technology. Unpack that a little bit for us.
Okay, so multiverses, the best way I know to explain it to anybody is just to say sliding doors, because everyone seems to remember that Gwyneth Paltrow film. But it's an idea that not only poets and novelists are drawn to, but physicists. And really some very renowned physicists believe it, that we are living our finite lives, right? We're born and we die, but we're living them in infinite universes at the same time, and that our decision-making affects how our lives turn out. So yeah, finite, infinite. And so in this, in my book, this young man that Amy works for, his name is Donnie, is this genius programmer at Stanford, but he's really trying to come up with the next big thing. And he decides he's going to figure out, and he thinks he has, an algorithm that will get you to be able to tap into your multiverses. So, for example, if you didn't marry your husband, but you married your high school sweetheart, what would have happened? Or if you'd taken that job or not worn your seatbelt?
And so it's about the choices that we make and how we're sort of able to explore them through this technological imagination that you've introduced into the story.
Right. Donnie thinks that he can tell you what would have happened if you walked the other way.
Well, in real life, isn't that a question that we all ask ourselves about many decisions we've already made? You know, if we had met so-and-so earlier or later, if we had taken, as you said, if we'd taken the job that we didn't take, what would have happened? I mean, there's sort of a natural curiosity about that. Isn't there?
I think so. And in multiverse theory, if you could actually tap into these infinite things, you would find infinite answers to that question. But for Amy, she's got one very pressing question, and so she's kind of lured into being his guinea pig. And he gets her stoned, and he puts headphones on her, and she goes off on these wild journeys into what could have been her life, but is not her life now.
So what was her one, what was her most important pressing question? What does she want to most find
out?
Well,
she lost a baby. And what would have happened if that baby had lived? And what that would have meant for her life moving forward. Would she have married her husband? Would she have married the father of the baby? Would she have been a single mother? Would they have been friends? She's convinced herself the baby's a girl. She has three boys. What would that have been like? You know, her whole life would have been different.
Does she want in the real world, not the multiverse, to go there? I mean, and is there a way to go there?
That's interesting. She's not there yet. I mean, that she wants to go there. She just wants to know. But her son, one of her sons, Miles, that's all he wants to do, is travel through multiverses. And that's because kids are, you know, for people my age, some of this may be news, but like when I was telling my son about it, he's like, Mom, everyone knows about multiverse. You know, read Philip
Pullman.
For the
record, I didn't know about multiverse. Did you, Jim? Or?
Yeah, I did.
Oh. Okay, well, we're in the same group, and he's obviously ahead of the curve.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of science fiction has this stuff in it, and the Philip Pullman trilogy has it in it, and so Miles is already, and growing up in Silicon Valley, he's just steeped in it, and he just wants so badly to be able to travel between them. But he's a step ahead of his mother, who is a Luddite like me.
So if you actually had such an algorithm or device or whatever the word here is, I'm guessing there'd be a big market for it in the real world today. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, I'm sure there would be, but I think it would just become another kind of crack, like all this stuff is. I mean, what would you then do with it? I mean, it's sort of interesting, right? If you knew if you had taken that job, or if you knew that you had should have married that guy, should you do it now? Should you try to go back? What? And then if somebody else who you're involved with is looking at their own algorithms, how would that ever affect the present? You know what I mean? It's sort of this, it's so self-reflexive that, yeah, I think people would die to know, but I also think, you know, as much as staring into that phone can take you away from life, this could really take you away from life because it's all, as I said, it's crack.
Well, there's a paradox implicit in it too, because it's the road that you chose that took you where you are. I'm going to mix up my metaphors here, but if you're, you know, constantly reliving those different choices at those different points in your life, what does that do to the reality you're actually living in?
It's probably not very friendly to it. Though there are people, you know, you've known them in your life who are just always kicking themselves for that bad decision.
Yeah.
And this would be a chance for them to see if that's what made things not work or if it was actually them that made things not work.
So we don't have a multiverse algorithm yet, but we do have social media. Where people, Facebook, for example, Instagram, for example, Twitter, where people can create, and they do, their own personas.
Their best versions of themselves.
You know, making this up, you post your, I'm not making it up, you post your favorite pictures or your puppy. You don't post, you know, the dinner that went well, the wonderful dish. You don't do the one where you left the stove on and you burn the whole darn thing down. So we already do this. Do we not, to an extent?
Well, in some ways you do, because you can find out if, you know, the boy from camp, what happened to him, right? Now you can find out. You know, you can find anybody, right? You can find people who don't want you to find them. I mean, all the things that kept us private and apart now are gone, really, right? You've got DNA samplings, you've got the internet. You know, and some of that's good. There are people who were separated by war, or they were separated unbeknownst to them. They didn't know that they even had a connection. But other people probably should have stayed separated.
Well, it's ironic because we were talking about this in the green room, too, because technology is the sort of double-edged sword. It helps you find these lost connections, but it also seems like it has a real immediate human cost in terms of the real connections that you have with the person sitting next to you. And it seems like that's some of what you're describing here.
I think you do lose something with the person sitting next to you if you're on your phone. But, you know, in my book, there's a teenage son, Jack, and he has a girlfriend named Lily, and she lives in Dallas. And they only went out for 2 weeks before she moved to Texas, but they have now been going out for 2 years, and they're together every second of the day because they're on their phones. Yeah. So they go to school on their phones. They have sex over their phones and their computer. They have more intimacy online than they do when they're together, when it's awkward and you can say the wrong thing or you can tug somebody's hair by accident, you know, or she gets shy. But with the devices, they have a different kind of intimacy, and they also don't break up, you know, which they clearly would have if they were 16 before we had these devices. You'd have some phone calls and then it would fizzle. But now it doesn't have to fizzle because you're constantly together.
And they don't ever talk on phones now either. Right? I mean, just reflecting on my own teenagers at home, that the phone calls, I remember being a teenager and just being so excited to get a phone call. The phone doesn't ring anymore.
No.
It's all text messages and stuff and Instagram.
But they talk on FaceTime and they talk on, on Skype.
Yeah.
They have sex on Skype.
So you write in your author's note that, and I'm going to quote him, "My fears about an obsession with the internet have no bounds." Talk about your fears of the internet.
Well,
I mean, we have already, but maybe you can go into it and...
I mean, I started off with being afraid about loss of privacy.
Yeah.
I think once you lose privacy, you can never get it back. The book before this had to do, it was called This Beautiful Life, and what happened was there was a sexting incident where a young girl sent a really sexy video of herself to a boy that she had a crush on, thought she loved as an offering, and he hit, you know, forward and send to two friends, and instantly it was ubiquitously all over the world. By the end of the weekend, it was everywhere on every porn site, and
it went viral.
She couldn't leave her house. Yeah, and so that was what I was concerned about, were instances of privacy. And you know, and all around us, there were so many politicians. You know, between Carlos Danger and Hillary Clinton, and everybody alive seems to make the same mistakes. Everybody knows you're not supposed to put all this stuff on email and everybody does it. So because they don't understand the instrument. The instrument is so powerful and we've unleashed it with no understanding of it. But with this book and now even past this book, you know, you see what's happened with Facebook, and actually people in Myanmar are being slaughtered because of Facebook, and our elections were completely corrupted because of Facebook and because of things online and, you know, and bots and false news. And, you know, so it's really encroached on our lives in a way that we don't even understand. And I think it's scary. You know, there's a component in this book, Come With Me, about Fukushima, Japan, and that's the story of another really powerful mechanism, machine called nuclear power that people employ without any understanding of how to corral it and how to take it back and no exit strategy. And you saw what happened in Fukushima, right? And it's still happening every day. So, you know, when those reactors melted down in Fukushima, that radioactivity is going into the ocean every single day. That was March 2011. Where are we now? April 2019. Every single day. You can see traces of it in the milk in Marin County. So, you know, we just embrace these really shiny and, you know, powerful machines because we love that, right? Anything that makes us feel strong and it seems so cool, but without any understanding of how it works or how to take it back.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. We're delighted to join you four times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular POTUS channel. That's the Politics of the United States, channel 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a remarkable and talented team at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at J.M. Lutis. Joining me, as always, is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. He's also the author of 17 books, and you can connect with him on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Helen Schulman, a writer whose most recent novel, Come With Me, explores what technology is doing to families, among other things. She's a 2019 Guggenheim Fellow for her writing and the fiction chair in the MFA Creative Writing Program at the New School in Manhattan. So are these ideas front and center in your mind when you're writing? Or did you say when you wrote Come With Me, did you want to explore what technology is doing to families? Or was it you wanted to tell a story and this is just sort of the byproduct?
You know what, I tend to be a person who gets obsessed about things, and I do a lot of research just because I do. I get really obsessed. I was really obsessed about Fukushima. Silicon Valley, my husband grew up on the Stanford campus, and honestly, I was sick of writing about New York. As I was telling these gentlemen, I grew up on the east side, I live on the west side of Manhattan, I took a bus across. You know, I wanted a different territory.
But you did come to Rhode Island, so
I did. I took a train to Rhode Island.
So see, you're branching
out. I go places. But my husband grew up on the Stanford campus, and so for 30-something years, I was visiting his family there and watching the landscape change completely. And I was interested, actually, in Sheryl Sandberg for a while, this sort of mother figure who had to corral baby geniuses, boys, immature boys. And that morphed into my character and her own boys and Donnie.
Do you have any thoughts on how this can be countered, for lack of a better word? I mean, this has been the history of technology from the steam engine. It's embraced, not by everyone, but by most people. Unintended consequences. We see the advent of the automobile, unintended consequences, the advent of TV. Same, time and time again, technology has this double-edged sword effect. And I think we could all agree that with these devices and the internet, we're in a whole new world, but it's the same situation. People gravitate, great thing, and boom. Then we realize
there are dangers that lurk.
Yeah,
I don't know.
How do we counter this? Do you?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm not a scientist, and I can barely turn on my computer. You know, I just see it. I feel like my job is to see it and record it.
Yeah.
And what I've done with my last few books is I've taken some kind of earthquake in the culture, large one, like the internet, like 9/11. I wrote about 9/11. I wrote about Holocaust revisionism. But I see it through the lens of an individual or a couple or a family and how those earthquakes affect the individual. So I'm always interested in the person and the human story. But, you know, you're living inside of history, and history is affecting your life. And that's interesting, I think.
Where does your inspiration... I think you've talked about where you get the ideas for these stories, these earthquakes, but are you self-conscious of your own values as you're sort of reflecting on these universes that you're creating? You're creating these multiverses.
I feel like my job is to sort of be making time capsules. I don't try to take sides in the stories, and everybody's got warts, and so does technology. I just wanted to lay it out there, so that you can see that it's not just the family that I'm writing about where the girlfriend comes to dinner every night via device. Because so many of my friends say they have that in their life, that there's somebody present in their life who's not physically there because their kid's in love with them. So I'm just trying to capture it.
Doesn't fiction, though, have a unique power to illuminate the real world? I mean, I think your books are clearly testament to that, because your storytelling in a fiction setting, which draws people in, you create characters, emotion, and all of the best of storytelling, but you're also illuminating real life. Talk a little bit about that, because it's more than just reading a mystery. When you read your books, you're reading more than that.
You know, I believe in fiction. I love fiction. Right now, there's a whole movement towards autofiction and reality and memoir. And I love those, too. I'm not against any writing. I love to read, and I like to write it sometimes. But for me, there's always been a greater truth in fiction, an illuminating truth that could come out of fiction that doesn't come out of other things. And I remember reading Tim O'Brien's book, The Things They Carried, when I was quite young. And that whole idea of story truth being truer than truth. And I bought into it. So yes, I'm crafting a truth. or what I believe to be a truth, but it's never autobiographical and it's never about a real living person. It just kind of all comes together. My husband says it all goes through the blender, and that's really what happens.
How do you create characters? I realize you could do a master class on that, but how do they take shape in your mind?
It's such a funny thing. Because it's really, as you were saying, that it was like multiverses. Like when I first read about multiverse theory, I thought, oh, that's what I do all day long. That's why I'm thinking about all these people I don't know, and I'm trying out different things for them, and this could have happened, and that could have happened. I'm not really crazy. It's just multiverse theory. And that was kind of a relief. But yeah, they become very real to me.
But how do they arise in your mind? Where'd Amy come from?
I had a friend who worked at Google, and I thought about her. I thought a lot about, one of the big themes in my books is how hard it is to be a girl. And it's so hard to raise children and work and be married and older parents. And I really just, her beleaguered state and the way she has to hold it all together because her husband's unemployed was something that I was really interested in. Jack's girlfriend, Lily, is really been raised to be an object of beauty and desire by a mother who has tried that and failed at it. But, it's like all the pressures on that kid to be sexy and beautiful and docile and wanted really leads her to a terrible place. These are things that I think about a lot, and then I just start building these characters, and I guess all my ideas start flowing through the characters.
Do you live with your characters? Excuse me. We've had writers on the show who talk about living with their characters. They're in their minds when they're awake, and sometimes they're in their dreams. Padma Venkatraman, one of our great guests, another author, talked about that quite specifically. Do you have that experience too, that they I don't want to say consume you or obsess you, but...
Well, towards the end of the book, I really feel that way. Like when I'm two-thirds there and I see the finish line, I live in New York in Manhattan, and I walk across Central Park pretty much every day to go to my gym. And that's where I do a lot of my thinking, is in that walk. But like towards the end of writing a book, I'll stop and sit down and like every bench to send myself a message or write a note down, because it's in my head so much. Lines are just coming to me and ideas are just coming to me. That's the best time of writing. I love that because the beginning is so hard.
Is that a morning walk? I'm very curious.
Yeah, it's a morning walk.
Okay.
I've never dreamed about them, but I had dreamed serial dreams about people I don't know. And I think that must be because I'm a fiction writer. Like places I've never been, and they're people in it who I've never met, but I dream about them. And
do you ever take those situations and people from your dreams and bring them into your writing?
No.
Not yet.
But it's just not.
Not yet.
I'm just saying.
I don't know. God knows what's going to happen next.
You've also done some writing for the screen. The film P.S. with Laura Linney, you were a screenwriter on. How is it different writing for the screen as opposed to writing a novel?
Well, P.S. was an adaptation of my novel, P.S. And then I got adapted by my director, so that was an interesting experience. Some stories come to you. That one was a short story, and somebody said, that would make a great novel. And I said, oh, yeah. And I wrote the novel. And then somebody said, oh, can you write it as a screenplay? Next it was going to be a breakfast cereal. It just kept morphing into a different kind of form. But some things I've written, screenplays, can only be screenplays. I thought of them visually. When you're writing a screenplay, you're really writing a sequence of pictures, visual pictures. Dialogue matters, but not so much as the visual melody that you're creating. And that's very different than writing a novel, where you can get so dense and so deep into the language and just really luxuriate in the incredible language that we are speaking now, English, which is amazing and has so many different offshoots and so many different dialects, and I just love it.
So are these screenplays you're talking about now, not the one that was produced, Are these original screenplays that you do, or are they adaptations?
Some have been original. I've written original screenplays. I've rewritten. I've co-written. I've written a lot.
Do you enjoy that more than writing a novel? Or you also do nonfiction, and you do short stories in addition to books.
I mean, right.
You kind of do it all, but do you sign? Is this more or a different kind of satisfaction in a screenplay?
Oh, fiction writing is much more satisfying. It's just so much harder. I mean, it's just, you have to, you know, you're bleeding into the page every day. I mean, it takes everything in you to write a novel. Screenplays, people take you out to lunch.
And then they don't produce your screenplay,
right? That's
right,
but you get health insurance, and it's only 110 pages, you know what I mean? There's a form, you know? It's a much lighter enterprise.
Well, whether you're talking about a screenplay or you're talking about a novel, when you're telling a story, do you know how the story's gonna end when you start writing it?
I don't, but I like to have a sense of what I want the reader to feel at the end pretty quickly. You know, I like the chord that I want to end on. I like to get a sense of that pretty quickly, because I wrote a novel about a Holocaust revisionist called The Revisionist, and that took me 7 years to write, and it was really like going into Vietnam. I got in, I had no plan what to do, what I was doing there, and no exit strategy. And it made me crazy. You know, and it took forever. And I'm not even sure I totally cracked it when it was done and published, because I really didn't know, like, what it was I was trying to say. So, yes, in the beginning, I have no clue, but I like to have a sense of what I want to feel, what I want you to feel when it's over, and then write towards that.
We got about 15 seconds left.
Oh, wow.
Can you tell us what you're working on now?
I can't.
You can't?
No, because the bubble would burst. But okay. I have started a new novel.
We'll certainly respect that. And we'll have you back when it surfaces.
Thank you. That'd be fun.
Yeah. I hope it's not 7 years.
Thank you.
Okay.
Helen Shulman, thank you so much for being with us. The most recent book is Come With Me. You should check it out. That's all the time we have this week. But if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or visit pellcenter.org, where you can always catch up on previous episodes. He's G. Wayne Miller. I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.